VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Wine Times, the podcast brought to you in association with the Sunday Times Wine Club. I'm Annika Rice. Will Lyons, vice president of the club, and fair to say a wine guru, is on my right.
A guru? Well, I like that, Annika. That's very nice, isn't it? Yeah. And I'm particularly excited about today because we have the great Michel Roux Jr. joining us here in the Tap and Bottle.
I know, we're very... Hello, so Michel.
Not as excited as me, I must say.
You don't need an introduction, but here's one we've prepared anyway. The Roux name, I mean, it's food royalty, let's face it. You are the owner of Mayfair's exquisite Le Gavroche. Well, were, I think we should qualify that with. More of that in a minute. It was started by your dad and your great uncle, Albert and Michel. It was the first UK restaurant to be awarded 1, 2, and then 3 Michelin stars. It's quite impressive. We could end there. But we'll also talk about your TV roles, your judge on MasterChef, The Professionals, presenting roles on Saturday Kitchen, Food and Drink, and much more. You've written many classic food books, including the award-winning Matching Food and Wine, which again, we'd like to talk about in a little while. So we have our work cut out today. Welcome along. Thank you very much. And I just have to say, first off, that we talk about the Gavroche just now. Now, I'd barely been to a restaurant in my entire life up until the age of about 15, but possibly the Wonky Wok in Croydon or something like that. And then my boyfriend's parents took me to Le Gavroche. That was my first experience of going to a restaurant. And I've never forgotten it. The souffle. That's what I remember. And also, because the Wonky Wok didn't have a lot of waiter service, I found it absolutely extraordinary the way waiters would glide from behind sort of curtains and fill your wine glass. I loved it.
The cheese souffle is...
Up until a few days ago.
The bestseller. It is incredible.
Well, tell us what's happened. You've let it go. After all this time.
The souffle suisse has flown away.
It's flown away. And you've let the restaurant go.
That's right. Yes, after 57 years, I decided that it was time to shut the doors of the iconic Le Gavroche. But the name will carry on. I'm not prepared to let go of the name.
No, don't let go of the name.
It's part of me, so I would never want to sell that part. It's very, very close to my heart and to the Roux family. So what I'm planning to do is to take Le Gavroche on the road, as it were.
Yes. Could we come too, Will and I? We can offer all sorts of... What could we offer? Well, Will obviously can offer something very exciting.
I think the brand, it's so classic, but also, you know, you just sort of descend the steps. What I love about Gavroche is it was one of the only places in London, perhaps the world, where they do everything in terms of wine very traditionally. So if you have if you choose the Bordeaux, the sommelier comes, he decants it with a candle.
You know, didn't use a corkscrew?
No, sorry.
That's clever. How do you do that?
It's magic.
That would be good for the tour.
So there was a corkscrew first, and then you decant it into the bottle, the decanter.
That's good.
Over the light of a candle, so you can see just where that sediment is.
I do remember all that. I do. And of course, you know, so many chefs, Marcus Waring, Gordon Ramsay, Marco Pierre White, they all cut their teeth in your restaurant.
That's right. And not just the, you know, sort of household names, Monica Galetti as well, people like that.
Monica.
But it's all the others as well that have gone on to do great things. But most importantly, have then trained more chefs. So, you know, that's what's incredible. And mentorship and passing on knowledge is such an important part to me and was to my father and uncle. Mm. And that, I think, is what's made Le Gavroche what it is. And it's being able to pass on that knowledge and to train the next generation of chefs. And then that generation of chefs is going to train more chefs.
Yeah. And you always talk about teenagers and liking to work with young chefs, don't you? You know, you like sort of getting people in with that raw talent.
It makes me feel young. You know, when I go into work and I see these young apprentices and they're, you know, the eyes light up when you teach them something new. And it's not just the kitchen, it's front of house as well. You know, and you know, passing on that knowledge and getting them infused in this wonderful industry, which is the hospitality industry.
I sort of imagining, I might have got this wrong, having done Hell's Kitchen with Marco Pierre White, which was...
And you survived?
The most brutal experience of my life. But I did learn that butter, salt and cream, that's what it takes to create anything that's delicious. But the kitchen atmosphere was so brutal. I know it was a television programme, but I'm sure that's replicated for real in many a restaurant. But you imagine in Le Gavroche, Roche, you're saying, I say, oh boy, could you possibly pass that? No?
Well, not necessarily quite in that fashion. it is tough. Of course it's tough, but it should never be brutal. There are times where, yes, you're asked to work long hours, but you know, you could be asked to work long hours, not forced into it and not treated in a bad way. And I think that's so important. And yes, you need to be, especially in service, you need to be switched on and it is full on commitment. But you know, there is no place at all ever for bullying or for, you know, intimidation. We want the next generation of chefs to fall in love with this industry, not to hate it and to fall out of love and to leave the industry.
Yes.
So, you know, as you know, all of hospitality has to, you know, have to look at themselves and think, hey, come on. Let's do this properly.
It's not boot camp.
It should never be boot camp.
Do you think we've come out of that genre of shouty chefs now? That was feels like a sort of late 90s, early noughties.
Yeah, I bloody hope so. I mean, it's not because I went through a tough sort of beginning of my career that the youngsters now should go through that. You know, quite on the contrary. You know, people like myself of my age should learn from their experience, positives and negatives, and make it better for the next generation. And that's key.
And you two, of course, hobnob on cruise ships.
Well, we were very lucky. We had a real treat.
Will's always coming back and saying, yeah, Michelle and I do, you know. When we were on the captain's table, Michelle and I. And
we crossed the Atlantic on the QM2, didn't we? We went from Southampton to New York.
Dream job.
And Michelle bought Le Gavroche at sea, which was incredible.
And you brought your wine expertise.
And I did a wine night an evening. I don't know if we should say this, but it was the evening where we sailed as close to the iceberg that hit the spot where the Titanic. So it was very, and the sea was as flat as a mill pond that night, because when we were crossing, you know, 5 days, we had 3 days of pretty choppy weather.
Did they flag that up as a tourist attraction? We are about to now.
No, they
cross
don't.
The
I
moment.
Was a bit. I was a bit. I was a bit obsessed with that.
So it's just you.
But they do mark on the map.
They do.
But I was going to ask myself, what was it like cooking when the whole ship was moving? I mean, that must have been a very new experience for you.
Yeah, I mean, the kitchens on the Queen Mary are absolutely unbelievable. State of the art.
Are they?
Oh, gee whiz. Yeah. I mean, the amount of stainless steel and new modern kit in those kitchens is just like the envy of any professional kitchen. And the level of the staff that work there is very, very high. So it was great to be part of that team. And we delivered some fabulous food. So Le Gavroche at sea did happen.
There you are. You see, you've practiced your tour already. You've done the prototype of it. You know how it's going to work.
That was it. The first one.
The first one.
I just want to interject, because you also did something really clever. So in the other dining rooms, you had Le Gavroche was at the top. You had certain nights, Michelle would cook a course. And so you'd have it on the menu, Le Gavroche option. And was it the lamb? It was outstanding. I mean, it was such a sea change in quality from the other food that was being offered. I thought, how on earth have you done this? You must have come in, taught all the chefs how to prepare it, And then they.
So what, they had the sort of Gavroche in one restaurant and then the Wonky Wok, which obviously I'd be in.
Yes, and then you'd have
one course.
And then you'd have one course you could pick. But
in newspaper bag,
which was incredible. Yeah, but it was outstanding, actually.
There was 2,000 portions of stuffed saddle and lamb sold that night.
Oh,
and it was incredible. But a lot of work goes into the recipe preparation before. So we send the recipe, we send pictures, step-by-step pictures. And then 2 days before, we make it and cook it as well, so that all the chefs on board have seen it and understand the recipe, and then we go live. So there's a lot of hard work that goes into it beforehand. Yeah.
A lot of foreplay on that meal.
Oh, yeah, because we had to do an interview before the ship left, and you did look quite stressed. That
I said, there's been a work. You were like, not a lot of work.
What about our wine?
Our wines, well.
Since we ought to...
We're sort of in
obviously, France is our region today.
I mean, it's the home of wines. I think we can say that without picking it up. But what I've tried to do on the first wine, we're going to that sort of magical province just over the foothills of the Vosges Mountains. We're going to Alsace, which is a region which is beautiful. It's sort of, especially at this time of year, Christmas markets, medieval squares, little wineries that haven't changed for hundreds of years in these sort of old, you sort of go up a cobbled side street and then you'll find this wonderful sort of fairy tale house, and inside there'll be a winery. But it's a region known for white wine. But I'm thinking counterintuitively, and I've actually got our first wine is red. It's a Pinot Noir.
Mm.
So if you can, actually, I'm going to pass it along. So it's a 2016 Pinot Noir from Domaine Botchgeil.
Thank you.
In Alsace in France. And Annika loves red wine.
And I swallow. I just can't be doing this. But even though I'm going on to do another job, everyone's going on to work. I just go on being the very best version of myself.
Yeah.
Which is slightly, happy.
And obviously climate change, climate chaos is a bad thing. But there has been some aspects of it, which means that there's been change in the wine world. Mm. And one of those is Pinot Noir. You can ripen it now in traditional areas where perhaps traditionally you couldn't. I'm thinking of Germany, Canada, certain parts of England, but certainly Alsace. And if you smell this, we just lower our nose in. I mean, I think that was a Burgundy, which is the home of... The home of Alsace.
I'm really pleased you did choose a Pinot Noir from Alsace, because it's one of those regions which I think often gets neglected, and even for regular tourism, it's one of the most beautiful regions in France. Great food, the people are wonderful, and it has great history to it as well, if you want to scratch beneath the surface as well, and some fabulous wines. Obviously the whites, but the red Pinot Noirs I think are fabulous because they're juicy, they're fruity, and they go so well with food.
Yeah, I'm always asked, where's the next big thing? What have you found, Will? And people want me to say something like Tasmania or Romania. And I always say, look, just look under your nose. Mm. And if you go into France, it could be the Loire Valley, it could be Alsace, and you have a sniff around and you think counterintuitively, you can pick up some incredible wines.
Right, are we having a sip? Are we going in?
Sorry. Will takes half an hour, so you have a sip and you and I can just crack on, frankly. And...
Mm.
Oh, it's a long action in the mouth.
So I've got that. And it has that spiciness, almost
crispy.
It's almost Christmassy, actually. Alsace is a region which, it's sandwiched between France and Germany. And if I was tasting that blind, I'd actually probably think that was a Spätburgunder, from Germany, because it has that sort of clovey character, I think.
So where does that come from? The soil or the climate or the...
I think it's the ripening season. So we don't want to get too technical. It's the hang time, and it's that cool climate, doesn't it? It just preserves those aromatics.
Mm. I think
it's got wonderful balance, great fruit,
and
it's light.
Yes, light, exactly.
You should be able to swallow a sip of that, Michelle.
You can have a bottle of this quite easily, I think, without even realising it. It's one of those wines, I think, that you... A boire sans soif. To drink without having a thirst. You could just be drinking that.
I love that expression.
What was it like as little boy, Michel, growing up in, your very foodie household, were you encouraged to sip a glass of wine
at
a young age?
Oh, gosh, yes, yes, yes. I mean, I was brought up, and I was born and raised in the UK, in Kent, but I was definitely brought up as a French child.
Yeah.
And that meant, yes, very, very early introduction to wine.
Like what age?
And, probably sniffing wine at the table, giving a you know, sort of...
Just checking it out.
Sniff that, you know. Dad would come over and have a sniff of that. Trempe les lèvres, dip your lips in it. Trempe les lèvres. I would say probably at the age of 7, 8.
Yes.
And meanwhile, you were under the table, weren't you? And instead of being given toys, you were given sort of puff pastry
with. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Extraordinary.
No, no plasticine. I was given puff pastry to play with and a rolling pin. but yes, and I think that's really important, you know, to be introduced to wine as something that you have during the meal and at a certain time of day, and to get enjoyment from it and to understand what it is, rather than no alcohol until you're drinking age, and then you just
go mad.
Exactly.
And have you
and
done
binge
that?
Drink.
Have you done that with Emily, your daughter?
Was she
under the table with the puff pastry? Or have moved on? Is the sort of PlayStation equivalent of the puff pastry for her?
Yeah, but she ended up being a chef as well. So, it worked.
It worked, but, whatever you're doing.
But no, introduction to alcohol, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to understand that you sit down at the table to enjoy food, and it's a very special moment, even if it's not, you know, a family gathering. But it's a special moment to be at the table, and there are certain times where, yes, a glass of wine, is right with your food, with your meal.
It's funny because we were recording an episode on Greece, and I dug up some wine advice from the ancient Greeks. I mean, this was writing, you know, in the 5th century BC. And it was Eubulus who was saying that 3 glasses was enough. And it's absolutely right, isn't it? And, you know, and if you look at a modern wine bottle, it's 6 glasses. Mm. So it's 3 each.
Yeah.
Michel, we were saying in the introduction, you've written about pairing wine with food. And can you have a sip of, say, this wine without immediately thinking of what should go with it? Or are they just so linked that they have to go together?
For me, they are so linked. I mean, as soon as I do have a little sniff and a taste of a different wine, I go, ooh, what would that go with? And for me, this, I mean, would be lovely paired with Alsace charcuterie, pâtés, terrines, lightly smoked meats.
Check it out again.
And I think, you know...
Because it has that acidity, it will go with fatty things as well.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm thinking lamb as well. But then lamb goes with any sort of wine, really.
It's a shame I haven't brought along some charcuterie because I think it would work really well.
Well, no, but when we're all on tour together, we can add that to our
I can
thing.
Tell that Michelle's really excited by this wine, which is nice.
Yeah, no,
it?
Well,
nice
well
to
done.
It, yeah.
No, for someone like you to be able to excite Michelle is quite...
No, genuinely excited about that. And I've always been a huge fan of Alsace wines. And thinking out the box is really, really, really cool.
This is Wine Times with Annika Rice.
And Will Lyons.
We'll be back with more great wine and conversations before you even get a chance to top up your glass.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Cross Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
I was so interested, I hadn't realised this, that you'd lived in Hong Kong for a while. Yes. I lived there from the age of about 19 to 22. I was a journalist over there. And I would just love to know about your life living in that tiny room in Aberdeen.
Yes.
Catching the bus into Central every morning.
Right.
I think it was the number 70 bus.
The number 70.
I was there with you and the Tai Chi and Victoria Park. You know, it was all these travel experiences must bleed into your experience as a restaurateur.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Really, really loved that experience. It was a six-month placement in Hong Kong working at the Mandarin Oriental.
Oh, wow.
How old
were you?
I was, I'm trying to remember now, 23, I think.
Oh, God, yeah. We were practically so there at the same time.
It was incredible. I mean, the vibrancy, the just that atmosphere and the buzz of Hong Kong was incredible. And the food scene. I mean, I do think that Hong Kongers and Chinese look at food in the same way as the French and the Italian and the Spanish do. It's more than just fuel. You know, every dish and every moment you sit down to eat has a meaning.
Yes.
And that's what captured my imagination. And also, of course, being exposed to, at that age, some incredible ingredients that I'd never seen before and cooking methods I'd never seen before. So that really opened up my eyes and as a chef, and the thrill and the enjoyment of going to Aberdeen Market and seeing that, you know, beautiful fish
the fish market there.
It's just yeah,
and also you're just in touch. It's such a vibrant, buzzy place, isn't it? I mean, everyone is there on a mission, Will. You don't just sort of hang around in Hong Kong having a holiday. No. It's the ultimate meritocracy, really, for the Chinese at the time. And you're there to earn a dollar.
Yes.
And there's an absolute thrust of the whole place.
There's an energy.
Yeah. I've never known anything like it.
Incredible energy.
And now, of course, it's a big wine city. So yes. I've hosted a number of wine tastings there. And what's interesting, what you're saying about flavours, is the way that the vocabulary and how we describe wine is very Western. So if you're talking about, you know, the sort of modern trend to describe wine in terms of fruit, you know, a lot of people living in Hong Kong probably won't have had the fruit that you're talking about, whether it's damsons
or
blueberries.
So what notes do you use? Yeah.
Yes, well, then you have to sort of think out. So that's why I like to keep it. That's why I quite like to talk about how it feels in your mouth, the sort of texture of it, the mouthfeel. In 2008, I think it was 2007-8, they reduced the import taxes on wine. So suddenly, all these people who are earning a dollar could suddenly buy their favourite fine wines from UK merchants.
They're not producing it themselves.
No, so it's become a trading hub like London and New York. This coincided with sort of renewed interest on the mainland. So China is now the largest producer of Cabernet Sauvignon in the world. And they have a region up near Beijing, which I haven't visited. I've been to Beijing and hosted tastings, but I haven't. It's an 8-hour drive, I think. And they are making, I mean, it's a work in progress, but they are making, you know, I don't want to sound too snobby about it, but respectable wine.
Oh, I thought you just said they weren't producing their own wine. No, that's
up in the mainland. So in Hong Kong,
they're there's no space in Hong Kong.
I think there's a vineyard in Venice, so they could.
Yeah, that's true. So mainland China there.
Yeah, how it's a big wine city is you just have a lot of connoisseurs there who are buying the finest wines of the world. Mainly French wines, Italian wines. Okay. And so it's on the circuit now. So you do London, Hong Kong, New York, where you probably wouldn't have done that when you were both living there. You wouldn't have seen the sort of...
Because I was working in the Mandarin Oriental, they had a really good wine list, but very, very few people would be picking those big, top, high-end wines.
Yeah.
It was maybe the beginning of that.
There's a place called the Crown Wine Cellars, which is an old British Army ammunition base built into the mountain, and it's full of wine now. It feels like something of Indiana Jones if you go in.
Next wine.
Well, we're actually going quite smart now, so
okay.
We're going.
Oh, good. We like that.
What's become almost out of reach for a lot of people. We're going to Burgundy, the home of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and we're going to Sassania Maraschet. It's a white wine, Annika.
Okay.
But it's one of the great white wines.
Oh, no, now you've told me. Now you've told me it's expensive. I'm going to love it.
Now, it's interesting that we've started with a red and we've gone to white. Well, there's three villages in Burgundy that Michelle will know. You've got Pouligny Maraschet, Sassania Maraschet, and Mercer, and they make the creamiest, the richest. Yep. And this is the 2019 Sassania Maraschet by Joseph Drouin. So Sanya Morrissey just has that power and intensity of Meursault. 19. And then on the
on the start. I like that a lot. Real. Oh my goodness.
So it's a 19, and it's made by...
It's very smooth, isn't it?
Maison Joseph Drouin, which were big négociants in the 1880s. But they really founded their feet when Maurice Drouin took over in 1918. The great variety is Chardonnay, which doesn't say on the label. So they expect you to know that it's made from Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. So in this instance, it's, well, I suppose what they would call, it's a lens of the local terroir, which is the vineyard site. Because in Burgundy... Quite rightly, they believe that it's the soil, it's the plot where the grape is grown that imparts the character and the flavour of the wine.
This is glorious, isn't
it? It's fantastic. You are sipping that.
No, I'm not sipping, I'm drinking.
Yeah, good. You see, that's all we needed. We needed to add a few £100 to the price tag to get Michelle... Well,
as soon as I clocked the yellow top there, I went, yes, I know where this is.
So you probably have this in Gavroche?
Yes, we do.
In the cellars, yeah?
He never makes dud wines. Drouin. And you know that you're going to get your money's worth with him.
Slightly honeyed texture.
Honeyed. Yeah. Honey perfume notes as well coming up afterwards.
And hazelnut. Length. And it's going to change. Great wine like that will change in the glass. I mean, really, we ought to be sitting in Gavroche having... awaiting the souffle.
Could we get a table for early evening and just segue on over?
There may be a few listeners that don't know where Burgundy are. We're leaving Alsace, we're going south. And it's a thin strip of land which starts in the suburbs of Dijon and then finishes, only sort of 30 miles long, and then finishes as you approach the suburbs of Lyon, I suppose. And at this at parts, it's only a mile wide. But if you took I'm thinking of hot air balloons because there was a famous episode with Keith Floyd when he went to Alsace and he went over the Vosges Mountain hot air balloon. He was terrified. But if you took a hot air balloon ride along Burgundy and you went back in time 300 years, it would be
the similar.
Virtually the same.
Yeah.
It's, you know, sort of medieval villages and towns.
It's a beautiful, beautiful part of the world.
And the vineyards there have been toiled for centuries.
And Lyon, Will was just mentioning Lyon. That's one of your favourite
absolutely
French cities.
Love Lyon. I worked in Lyon or just in outside of Lyon, a village called Mionnet for 2 years. And I love Lyon. It is a great city, wonderful city. And I must say, I prefer it to Paris.
Yes.
Paris is nice, yes. Of course, don't get me wrong. Beautiful architecture and it is the capital city. But Lyon has... I think much more going for it. The food scene, the wine scene as well. I mean, the wine scene,
gastronomic
scene. On the doorstep, isn't it?
All those little bistros that you come
up. It's the old part of Lyon, walking around there. It's just wonderful. It's just a great, great city.
I've never been to Lyon. Is it intimate like Paris?
Oh, it's even, I think it's even more intimate.
Yeah, I think it's so small.
And it has two rivers flowing through it.
Yeah.
Well, some say three because you've got Beaujolais as well flowing through it.
And there's some fantastic little bistros, isn't there? You don't have to travel very far. Mm. But that's a good argument, isn't there, Michelle? But if you think of a country like France or Italy or even America, and then going to the cities, the sort of off the beat, they're not off the beaten track, but they're the minor cities that you wouldn't necessarily think of first. Mm. Lyon is just like that, isn't it?
Well, especially if it's on the doorstep of this glorious region, you know, you've just described it.
You've got Beaujolais, Burgundy, and then the beginning of the Rhone Valley as well. So, I mean, it really is an incredible city to be in. But you're only an hour away from the ski stations and an hour and a half away from the Mediterranean. So it's a bit more than an hour and a half. Yeah, you'd probably get done for speeding if you did it an hour and a half. 2 hours.
But if you go by train, it all starts at Gare de Lyon, doesn't it?
Yes.
And you can nip into Le Tremble, which is the big famous restaurant there, have a steak tartare and a glass of sunset.
Oh, it does remind me. Oh, God, we still go interrailing at our age? Or does that stop when you're about 17? Because I used to love interrailing. That was a great way to travel around just Europe.
Because you hurtle down from Paris and you change trains at Dijon. Get you sort of a light from the TGV, and then you get on the little local train, which is magical because it cuts through all the vineyards of Burgundy, and you go through sort of Neuilly Saint-Georges, and then you alight.
You do your tour and you go to Lyon, could I come along on that little stretch as well? Are you writing notes here?
But it depends which way you want to approach Lyon, though, because we could fly into Avignon, couldn't we? Yes. And have a day there and then go up north through the Rhone Valley.
Yeah, Avignon's beautiful.
Avignon, I know that whole area of France is absolutely stunning, Avignon. I think that's my sort of favourite. And the Luberon Valley.
The Luberon, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We can't bear to leave this wine behind, but there is another one that we have to.
There is.
But we can keep that, Michel, glorious. On the burner, as they say. Well, the next one's been decanted.
Yes, but I'm going to pour it. I'm going to come off air because it is a bit tricky, actually.
Let me go, sir.
So, Will, we need to know why has that been decanted? I think I know the answer by now. I'm really learning a lot.
Well, it's from... So we're leaving Burgundy and we're going to France's largest fine wine region, Bordeaux. So we're probably going to fly across, actually. That's probably the best way to get there. It's a long old drive or a long old train journey. And we're on the left bank of Bordeaux. So this is a Cabernet Sauvignon. Heavy blend. And again, if you talk about magical journeys in wine, you know, I think the D2, which is this road, which you pick up from the suburbs of Bordeaux. And as soon as you get to there's a big roundabout, there's a chateau called La Lagune. Your heart soars because you know then you're in for this wonderful trip. And the first commune you get to is Margaux. And then you get to Saint-Julien, which is old English wine trade used to call the thirsty corner because you've got Béchevel on the corner. And then we get to where we are now, it's Pauillac. And Pauillac always produces the most powerful, I think, expression on the left bank. You've got that sort of graphite character. Mm. And the reason I decanted it is because it needs a bit of air just to open up. But I wonder whether Michel could have an educated guess.
He knows what's worth sipping. You see, it's absolutely gripping just watching this body language on my left.
It's a 2019, so it's an absolute baby. And it's called L'Epiphanie de Pauillac from France. It's been aged for 12 months in oak and then bottled. And I wondered whether you could have a sort of pinpointed guess of which chateau it may come from, actually.
No, but it's very good, and I'd love a piece of roast lamb with that, please.
It is a roast lamb wine, that, isn't it? Yes. It's a roast wine lamb. No, a roast lamb wine.
In 1855, Napoleon III, wasn't it, had a big exhibition in Paris, and he decided he wanted the finest wines from his kingdom. And so they went to, rightly or wrongly, they went to Bordeaux. They created a classification system, which is quite easy to understand for any wine lover, called first growth, second growth, third, fourth, and fifth. A bit like the English Football League. And it was all based on price, and it hasn't really moved. I think Mouton Rothschild was elevated in 1973 up to first growth. But this is fruit from the very top tier. So it comes from a chateau that is a first growth. So it's either Le Tour, Lafitte, Mouton Rothschild. The other two would be Margaux and Aubryon, but it's not them. I could say it off air where it's from, but what happens with the big secret of Bordeaux is they make so much volume compared to Burgundy. So the chateaus declassify their fruit. So they go through the and there's lots of fruit that just doesn't quite make the grade to go into the top wine, and they make a second wine and a third wine, and then they sort of sell off the rest of that fruit. This fruit comes from a very top chateau, probably the most famous and sought after chateau in Bordeaux. Two syllables.
And if you tasted the second grade down of the sort of slightly discarded,
it's like a
one.
Picasso sketch. It gives you an impression of the elegance and the severity. It lacks a little of the, if I was being critical, which I don't want to be because it's a great wine, it lacks a little of the intensity and the aging power of the Grand Vin, but it's certainly there.
Oh, well, I'm there with the roast lamb. It's
drinking beautifully, if you ask me. I think this is very, very nice.
Cedarwood. And do you like Bordeaux, Mish? One of your...
Absolutely.
And they're great. There's some wonderful
I like good Bordeaux. I like good wines. Unlike my father, who was, let's say, slightly biased, it was always French and always had to be French. I'm much more open, and I enjoy wines from all over the world and appreciate them very much so. But I always have a penchant for French wines. And I do think that the French wines go particularly well with food of that region. I think that's a little tip as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're looking for food and wine matching, look no further normally than what wine is produced in that, region, or what they drink in that region.
So what are you noticing? What are our new trends in food? Where are we going to go with that?
I mean,
you've eaten everything. I mean, a quick Google search. He's eaten everything. Puffin, kangaroo.
Yeah. Next thing, I'll be in the jungle.
Yes, it'd be a jungle, wouldn't it? You'd just go, lovely cream testicle. Love it. I would suggest that with a glass of the...
Have you done the jungle, Annika? I was thinking that last night. Have you?
No.
You haven't?
No.
There's a look of resignation.
No, it would be the sleeping arrangements. Funnily enough, I wouldn't mind anything else. It's just the thought of sleeping next to someone who snored.
And then you're on camera the whole time, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The jungle doesn't faze me at all. It's the Strictly Come Dancing one, which would definitely, 100%.
You'd be fit enough to do it, though.
Yeah, but yeah, dancing me? No, definitely not. Eating odd bits from different animals, that doesn't really scare me at all.
Where might food go? I mean, it can't keep reinventing itself or finding new markets, can it? I mean, it's doing pretty well at doing that.
It evolves and trends, you know, come and go, which have always happened. And we, you know, we see that tastes evolve as well.
Yeah.
That cooking methods as well. So, you know, it's constantly changing. And I embrace change. I think it's wonderful to see. Mm. And I think that's part of the reason that Le Gavroche was, you know, still doing so well after so many years, is that we were true to our roots, yes, very French and classical, but we had evolved over the years. Because and if you don't evolve, you stagnate. And if you stagnate, you're gone.
Do you think we're coming to the end of that sort of long tasting menu where you have 15 courses with 15 glasses of wine sometimes?
Yeah, they used to bore me to death. And they still do. If I see that, I run away. I think the ideal, if you're going to do a kind of tasting menu and want to get a real taste of what the restaurant has to offer, is about 7-8 courses max. And then 7 or 8 decent glasses of wine, not a tiny thimbleful that,
too frustrating.
When you're getting to 30 courses or things like that, the food, it's no more than a thumbnail of food.
Or it could be a thumb, possibly.
Could be. Yeah. You can't enjoy it.
It's too much to take in, isn't it?
It's far too much.
It's funny, you're talking about those sort of little amuse-bouche, tiny little bits. And certainly when I lived in Hong Kong, that changed the whole way I enjoyed eating, because I suddenly loved eating with chopsticks and just having little bits, taking off other people's plates, sharing. It's a very sharing thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But the one thing as well that always surprised me. Well, it surprised me at first when I first arrived in Hong Kong was the slurping that goes on
It's a noisy vibe, definitely.
And the more noise you made, the more you were actually enjoying the food. And that was just wonderful. It just brought me back to my grandma, who always slurped when she had her soup.
Well, that's been just a joy talking to you, Michelle, honestly. And we're part of history because we're here doing this podcast literally 2 days after you've closed that door for the last time.
It's incredible.
That's it, yes. It's extraordinary. The end of an era.
It really is the end.
But the beginning of a new one.
I have to find a new answer to the question because everyone always asks me, what's your favourite restaurant in London?
Oh, God, and you say, well,
the best is Gavroche. We'll have to find a new
one. You'll have to just say Le Gavroche Tour.
Yeah.
That's right.
We shall look forward to, you know, whatever your new plans are, Michelle. Thank you so much for coming and sipping 3 rather delicious wines today. Which is your favourite? I mean, silly question.
Oh,
last one?
Actually, no, probably the Chassin Marché.
Cheers.
Yeah. Well, that's it from us today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Wine Times in association with the Sunday Times Wine Club. The series producer is Anya Pierce, the producer Callum McRae, and the assistant producer has been Shana Johnson.
You can follow the podcast so you never miss an episode. Just do this via your favourite podcast app.
We'll be back next week with more delicious wines and another great guest.
And remember that all of the wines we tasted today are noted in the episode description, and you can get your hands on all of them from the Sunday Times Wine Club website.
But from all of us here at the Tap and Bottle, thank you very much for listening. We hope to see you next week for more Wine Times.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.